from KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Always hard put to recall them all, but the release of all political prisoners, the ending of the state of emergency, the repeal of the apartheid legislation on the books in the country, the unbanning of the anti-apartheid groups in the country. Now, some of the conditions have arguably been met, some have been only partially met, and some have not been met at all. The organizations have been unbanned. The state of emergency has been lifted in part, but one could suggest that even if it were lifted all across the country, the laws that give it muscle still remain very much in place. In South Africa, it doesn't matter whether or not you have a state of emergency or not. That's just a measure of art. The law is very much there to give the police virtually the same power, the state of emergency notwithstanding.
Mr. Randale Robinson, Executive Director of TransAfrica, the lobby group for Africa and the Caribbean. With a mandate from the Congressional Black Caucus back in 1977, Randall Robinson formed the organization with only two staff persons. Currently, the organization has 12 staff persons and one-tenth of the present operating budget of $700,000. TransAfrica does not have the kind of clout or the financial support of that of an American Jewish lobby that Israel has developed. But under the leadership of Randale Robinson, TransAfrica is asserting itself as an institutional expression and extension of Pan-Africanist work started by George Padmore, C.L.R. James, W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, and Paul Robeson. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. This week, TransAfrica with Randale Robinson in Black America.
There is no question that the Bush administration and President Bush himself want to lift these sanctions, and so they will attempt to interpret fulfillment of the conditions in a way that will allow them to do just that. I think several mistakes have been made. One was the invitation to Mr. de Klerk to visit the United States.
What was your reaction?
Oh, we're very much opposed to that, and that's not to suggest that I'm opposed to full diplomatic exchange and discussion. I think our Secretary of State should see Pete Bota. I think members of Congress should go there. Members of a parliament should come here. But the Oval Office is a special place that carries a different imprimatur of American support and embrace. There are many people in the world with whom we have a diplomatic exchange we don't invite to the Oval Office. Yasser Arafat hasn't been there and won't be coming. Fidel Castro hasn't been there and won't be coming. The same is true for many, many others, through Muammar Gaddafi. And I don't suppose Saddam Hussein will cross that threshold anytime in the future. The fact is that South Africa, aside from image, very much the same way Mr. Gorbachev has done in the Soviet Union, which is proving not to be authentic, aside from image, has not changed very much in South Africa. The apartheid law is still very much on the book. Blacks cannot vote. The Group Areas Act is still in place. The Separate Amenities Act, the Internal Security Act, the Land Acts, all of these pillars of the apartheid system are still very much in place. And he essentially has done two things, largely of public relations value, released Nelson Mandela, and unbanned the ANC so that there's above ground discussion.
On Thanksgiving Eve in 1984, Randall Robinson, and three others entered the South African embassy in Washington, D.C., and politely announced they would not leave the embassy until apartheid was abolished. Their arrest helped put apartheid on America's agenda. Sanctions were implemented, South Africans suffered, and 6 years later, Nelson Mandela was released from a South African prison. Recently, Randall Robinson brought his broad-based knowledge on South African and Caribbean affairs to the University of Texas at Austin during Black History Month celebrations. Before his presentation, this reporter sat down with this gentle, persuasive person to discuss his goals and objectives as executive director of TransAfrica.
It's difficult to get Americans to understand the problems that we faced are not peculiar to African Americans. We, in large part, live in a country of people who are woefully ignorant about foreign affairs in general. And so education is a major part of our responsibility. Unless people know about issues, you can't expect them to be concerned about those issues. But we've had some conspicuous success. I mean, we have sanctions now against South Africa because of the leadership of African Americans and because of the vigorous role that African Americans played in the campaign and drive for sanctions in Washington. So I think there is a real interest. There's still some issues we need to know a lot about, a lot more about, issues of U.S. Economic assistance to African countries, refugee policy, trade policy, all of those less than exciting economic issues that are tremendously important to countries attempting to develop their economies, but issues about which Americans in the main know very little. And it's not just a problem on the African issues, it's global. And in large part, that's why we've launched headlong into to a war that I think we will live to regret in the Gulf now, because most Americans don't understand anything about the Arab world or the consequences that we will have to face before this war is over and long after it's concluded.
Has the mood Americans have towards Africa changed since the formation of TransAfrica in 1977?
Well, I think we've come a long way from Tarzan.
Okay.
But we have still a very long way to go. I think Americans are less indelibly prejudiced in their images of Africa than they were. But I still think they are woefully badly informed, in as much as very few Americans know what the countries are of Africa. They think of the Caribbean as a beach and don't know very much about the rest of the world. Few Americans can name a province in Canada or a state in Mexico, for that matter. So it's not just a problem of our perceptions of Africa, but it's a kind of an American parochialism that's general, that is a problem in this country for black and white, rich and poor, east, west, north, south. It's a major American problem, and it's a large cause of foolish foreign policy in the last analysis.
How has the financial support for TransAfrica evolved over the years?
Well, we grew from an organization that started with a grant of $5,000 from the Africa Office of the National Council of Churches 13 years ago to an organization with a $700,000 a year budget and over $1 million in a small endowment with a national capital campaign now to buy our own home, a process that will be completed within the next year. So we've come a long way, and a large part of that support has come from the black community in the United States.
How has the staff grown?
Well, we started with me and a secretary. Now we have about 17 people and 12 chapters across the country and interns and volunteers.
Getting back to the answer to the question before this, when you spoke of information, is it American media here? Have they lost an interest in Africa, or is it incumbent upon African Americans to seek out that information to better inform about the continent of Africa and our foreign policy towards that country?
Well, American media hasn't lost an interest in Africa. Never had any.
Okay.
And it doesn't have any interest in any part of the world, save Europe, the Soviet Union, Israel, perhaps, but Latin America, Asia, Africa, the Caribbean are not hot topics in American media. And when you exclude perhaps the Washington Post and the New York Times, the coverage from the rest of the print media in this country is absolutely deplorable. Papers in Texas are conspicuous for deplorable coverage. When there's any coverage at all, it's bad. And that's not, again, not just a problem for Africa. It's a problem even in the current crisis in the Middle East, a crisis in which Arabs are depicted for the American population as something just the other side of savage. And so there are other people in the world who have suffered from this this sort of racist depiction. Black Americans have to learn, though, rather than to simply carp incessantly about racism, that nobody will take care of our interest for us. We need more blacks in the decision-making process in media across this country, at ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, the major papers, the wires. In every room where there's a decision made that's vital to our interest, we have to be represented. No one will take care of those interests for us. And so we need young blacks to understand that we have to be adequately represented wherever decisions are made in this country that affect our interest. But to do that, we have to train our young people in college to understand power and where our interests lie. And that's not always the case. Too many young people want to be in front of a camera as opposed to behind it. The important editorial decisions are not made by those who accomplish celebrity status in front of cameras, but by those who set media policy. Who decides what story is going to be written and how it's going to be written, how it's going to be edited? Who are the assignment editors at all of these papers? And that's how important decisions are made, whether the story will be on the front page, on the back pages, whether it'll be in the paper at all, whether it'll be above the fold or beneath the fold, how many column inches it'll get, whether it's going to make the news, the evening news or not. All of these things are determinations made by people. And if we're not in the room, you can't expect a favorable determination.
Your opinion of the black press in covering Africa and foreign policy towards that country?
Well, I think it certainly has been better than the white press. I am particularly impressed with a new magazine, Emerge, that's perhaps the most important magazine produced in black America in a very, very long time. And there's serious discussion and analysis, thoughtful debate. I know the people who are running Emerge, and of course they expect and anticipate to lose money for a few years. I only hope their pockets are deep enough to make this a viable undertaking. In the main, the rest of the black press is pretty frivolous business, with the exception of, to some large degree, I think, of course, of Black Enterprise. It takes up serious issues, to some degree, Essence magazine. But, and this is not to condemn the other publications at all, simply to say that plus media products reflect the community that is to consume those products. And people who run magazines and television shows are in business, and business must have a market, and it's really a question of the demand of the community that must consume the product. We must demand. You see, Johnson Publications started with a very serious publication, Negro Digest, that became Black World, and it failed, while Jet and Ebony thrived. There's a reason for that. The reason's not to be found at Johnson Publication headquarters, but it's to be found in the appetites of the black community. That's where the problem is.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message. And now back to this episode of In Black America.
Why did you feel it was important in 1984, Thanksgiving Eve, to enter the South African Embassy in Washington, D.C.?
Well, President Reagan had vetoed a moderate resolution of condemnation offered in the Security Council at the United Nations, condemning South Africa for arresting the entirety of the labor union leadership in that country that September. And it was just intolerable. It was a case in which P.W. Bolt had virtually become indistinguishable from President Reagan in attitudes about apartheid. And so we went to indicate our own consternation with American policy and South African policy, not having, of course, the faintest notion that 5,000 Americans would follow us at the embassy to be arrested, and that movement would galvanize American momentum to pass the sanctions that since 1986 have cost South Africa over $10 billion in lost income. So it's made a real difference. But there comes a time when people have to make a decision to do whatever is necessary to dramatize our feelings about issues like this. And Mary Frances Berry and Walter Fauntleroy and I at the time felt very strongly about it, and we had no reservations, and I think we've been vindicated. There are six conditions under the sanctions law. Five that are in one part of the law, and the sixth condition, four of the first five must be met for one or more of the sanctions to be lifted. But for all of them to be repealed, the sixth condition must be satisfied, and that condition is that apartheid has to have been substantially dismantled before all of the sanctions can be lifted. The other conditions, I'm always hard put to recall them all, but the release of all political prisoners, the ending of the state of emergency, the repeal of the apartheid legislation on the books in the country, the unbanning of the anti-apartheid groups in the country. Now, some of the conditions have arguably been met, some have been only partially met, and some have not been met at all. The organizations have been unbanned. The state of emergency has been lifted in part, but one it could suggest that even if it were lifted all across the country, the laws that give it muscle still remain very much in place. In South Africa, it doesn't matter whether or not you have a state of emergency or not. That's just a measure of art. The laws are very much there to give the police virtually the same power, the state of emergency notwithstanding. Then there's the question of the release of political prisoners. There's still many behind bars, and of course there's the argument about who is a political prisoner and who is not, and so that's the question. Then the issue of the unbanning of political parties, while the government says that has been done, you still don't have free passage in and out of a country of people who belong to those parties. And so that raised questions about whether the unbanning is indeed authentic. We met last year with Secretary Baker to discuss this, and had major, or at least some suggestion that we will have some difference of opinion over the last condition, that apartheid has to have been substantially dismantled. Of course, the other conditions are, in the main, objective conditions. This one, of course, is very subjective. And he indicated to us that could be a matter over which we might disagree. There is no question that the Bush administration and President Bush himself want to lift these sanctions. And so they will attempt to interpret fulfillment of the conditions in a way that will allow them to do just that. The apartheid law is still very much on the book. Blacks cannot vote. The Group Areas Act is still in place. The Separate Amenities Act, the Internal Security Act, the Land Acts, all of these pillars of the apartheid system are still very much in place. And He essentially has done two things, largely of public relations value: released Nelson Mandela and unbanned the ANC so that there's above ground discussion, which has given him an image of a reformer that in large part is undeserved. That's not to suggest that he has been acting in good faith, in bad faith. That the point is that much of what he's promised to deliver remains undelivered, and until we see that delivery, I think it's premature of the president to invite him into the Oval Office, because he has restored him to the community of acceptable nations in so doing. And so I think we see a good deal of hypocrisy in American policy in this regard. We're prepared to lickety-split invade Iraq. We gave sanctions no real opportunity to work there when the very president, who's was such alacrity, wanted to move ahead in Iraq, opposed sanctions against South Africa and continues to do so. So I think we've got a very hypocritical president and a very hypocritical policy process in this regard, particularly with respect to Iraq, since the very weapons our young men will be facing were supplied in large part by the United States, supported by the very president who now wants Mr. Saddam Hussein's head on a platter. But that's not new, isn't it? Noriega worked for us at one time, too, directly for President Bush. So it's important to remember that our policy seldom is rooted in any general morality that I can understand.
TransAfrica has initiated two programs, college programs, one at Lincoln University and the other at Spelman College. How did the initiation of those programs come about?
Well, they more than Lincoln and Spelman. As a matter of fact, they involve about 18 historically black colleges. But much of the leadership has come from Janetta Cole of Spelman, president of Spelman, and Niara Sadakasa, the president of Lincoln University. Norman Francis down at Xavier in New Orleans has been very vigorous in this regard, too. The idea is to find young black men and women who want to pursue careers in foreign affairs. Even those who don't know they want to pursue careers in foreign affairs, to interest them, to make them aware that such careers are available to them, and to prepare them to take the Foreign Service exam, to get up the pass rate of blacks who take that exam. Again, as I was talking about in the press, if you expect to influence policy in media, in business, in foreign policy, anywhere you are in any sphere, you have to be in the room and you have to be well represented. And if we're going to do that in foreign policy, we're going to need more ambassadors, we're going to need more foreign service officers, we're going to need more people at the Agency for International Development, more people in the Congress, more people at the Commerce Department, at Treasury, the World Bank, the IMF, all of these places. We need to have our people representing as well, and we need to make our young people aware of these career opportunities. The only American government agency in the area of foreign policy that vigorously recruits on black campuses and on predominantly white campuses, vigorously recruits blacks, is the CIA, and that's indeed tragic. But what we've got to know, again, back to my notion that there's no point just copying about racism. For people who have power and abuse it, they don't cherish the notion of sharing it with anybody, so nobody's going to come looking for us saying that we've been hogging the decision-making process and we think this is wrong and might come and share it with us fairly. That's not how the game is played. We've got to discover how the world is run, and to demand our rightful place at the decision-making table, and that's a table with many chairs and many tables and many rooms, and we've got to be in all of them. And this program is to acquaint kids in college with this as a career opportunity and prepare them to take and pass this exam. It's a very difficult exam. And historically, we've had a very poor pass rate. But the others who take the exam have exam preparation courses. We've got to give our kids the same edge, and that's what we're doing with the historically black colleges now.
This program will also be on the elementary school level also?
In the long term, certainly at the high school level, because so much of the of whatever success you're going to have in taking this exam turns on your grasp of general information. It's not the kind of exam that you can prepare for well in a cram course. You might be asked where the Pyrenees are. You might be asked, or where is Peru, or where is the Amazon, what's the largest river in the world, where is Xhosa spoken. You might be asked a range of things, the Ural Mountains, the Ba'ath political party, all of these sorts of general information questions that you'd be best able to answer were you to start reading early on in the process. And so our young people really need to read Time and Newsweek and Emerge and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, read op-ed pieces, read foreign newspapers, read and read and read and read. And when you get towards your senior year in college and beyond, ready to take an exam like the Foreign Service exam, you'll find that all pays off. The black male in this country is in frightful danger. When you look at the figures of what's happening in our cities, and you've added to it crack cocaine, that not just jeopardizes the black male anymore, but the black woman. And children born into a world of crack, bonding not possible between mother and child, all of these things are happening in the black community, a community where production of children is greater from the bottom than it is from the top. And so some sort of intervention is vitally necessary. And it starts with, I think, a good view of yourself. I mean, you can't have a worldview unless you have world information. And you can't be an activist on that level unless you have a positive view of yourself and your place in the general scheme of things. And I don't think we have that like we should. I think perhaps we're better than we used to be, but I still think we have an awful long way to go.
The late Randall Robinson, attorney, author, and founder of Trans Africa. Robinson died on March 24, 2023. He was 81. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez and Cliff Hargrove, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.